What's up, everyone, and welcome to Type 1 Diabetes Day. April 15th holds a very special place in our community. If you don't know about this important day, don't worry. That's what I'm here for. Type 1 Diabetes Day is in honor of Jakiya Monique Furtick, who lost her life to diabetes in 2019. Jakiya's mother, Corinne Logan, created this day to honor Jakiya's memory in 2019. The Healthy Diabetic Podcast and Sanofi, today's special guests, wish to dedicate this episode to Jakiya's memory and ask you to wear blue today, April 15th, and every April 15th moving forward. Diabetes has taken too many lives. Help me and the diabetes community to remember Jakiya's life by keeping her and her family in your thoughts. Now, in light of Type 1 Diabetes Day, let's get with Sanofi and the amazing guests who are going to talk to us about screening for type 1 diabetes. Welcome back to the Healthy Diabetic Podcast. As always, before we get started, please remember that nothing that you hear on this podcast should be considered medical advice or otherwise. Please always consult your medical team before making any changes to your diabetes management. Okay, we're just going to jump right into today's multiple guests. I got to sit down with Luigi and Nadia from Sanofi. And if you don't know anything about this company, they are working tirelessly to educate the diabetes community on the importance of screening for type 1 diabetes. If you have multiple kids in your family with type 1 diabetes, if you have diabetes in your family, if you are a diabetic and you have kids, you're going to love this episode because, like me, I was educated about screening in this episode. I thought I understood screening, but now I know screening on a whole different level. So this is just, it's a, such an incredible episode. But before we jump in, I do want to take just a quick second and just introduce both of our incredible guests. So we've got Luigi Meneghini as the VP and U.S. Medical Head of Type 1 Diabetes. Dr. Meneghini leverages his 30 plus years of experience in diabetes care and research to help transform Sanofi's medical approach and engagement for diabetes management and prevention. Dr. Meneghini is a board-certified endocrinologist with a medical degree from Emory University and holds an executive MBA from the University of Miami. And then we have Nadia Fontaine. She serves as general manager of Sanofi's U.S. Type 1 diabetes franchise. Nadia is a trailblazer in the industry. She's renowned for her exceptional leadership in commercialization and strategic launch preparation. Nadia is a graduate of McGill University in Montreal, Canada, with a degree in finance and marketing. Two incredibly intelligent individuals. I cannot wait for you guys to listen to this episode. So without further ado, let's get with Luigi Meneghini and Nadia Fontaine from Sanofi.
Ken, before you start, can I ask you, when you say you're coaching, yeah, what do you mean by that? Because that could have a lot of different nuances.
Cool. So I'm a strength coach by trade. That's what I started my career, basically doing personal training, strength conditioning, basically for 15 years now, more than 15 years. So 2008 was my first year. I was coaching adults in the morning and coaching athletes in the afternoon and the evening when they get out of school. I'm still doing that. I'm just not doing afternoons anymore because I'm doing this. So the coaching aspect for me is focusing on coaching people that are affected with diabetes, whether it's a caregiver, type 1, LADA, prediabetes, type 2 diabetes. Focusing on specific things that are basically barriers for them to have success living with diabetes, whatever that might be. And I've got a whole entire process that I go through when I take on new clients as an onboarding process, because there's so much information that I need to understand to be able to take an individual through specific coaching sessions. So my signature coaching program is called More Than A1C, because we focus so much as a diabetes community, so much on that A1C number that we forget about all of the other complexities of diabetes. And that A1C number is only painting a picture of our life with diabetes anyway. So being able to get someone's mind wrapped, especially a newly diagnosed diabetic, getting their minds wrapped around that, because that number is pushed on us so hard when we're first diagnosed, when we go to see our doctors, that's the metric that they look at, which I understand why, but there's other things, other metrics that we have to look at. Is this person on a CGM? Do they understand how to look at trends and look at data? And what does all that data mean? I'm not telling them about how to basically go into fixing their insulin pump. That's out of my school of practice. But what I can do is I can say, okay, I see you're trending or consistently going high here. What's going on? We need to have awareness around why that's happening so we can make an adjustment and build a strategy around to not let that happen.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's great. And that resonates. I was in practice in academia for 27 years, and I consider myself a coach because that's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. Right?
Trying to get them to understand what's going on. That's kind of cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for that explanation.
Very good. It's excellent.
Yeah. I mean, I could go on about that forever, but
I'm
here for that. We're here for you guys. awesome. So, Jack awesomely, gave a little intro about both of you. So I want to say thank you to you guys for being here. I was really excited when I got to connect with Jack and be able to bring your guys' company onto this podcast, this show, because not enough people out there, one, understand screening, but two, understand that it's even an option. So I'm really excited to dive into this with you guys because you guys are going to be able to give a lot of really good information about, one, the company, and two, why screening is so important or why it might not be important for a specific individual. So I think the first question I'd love to ask both of you, and you guys can kind of go back and forth on who's going to ask each question, or you both can chime in and give your perspective on the specific question. But I think the first thing is I would love to give the listeners a background understanding about the company, like, you know, what the company is, when was it founded, what's the mission and vision of the company, what is the main focus right now, and then what ultimately is like the company's maybe vision over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. More than happy to do that. So, especially because I've been with this company for 24 years, so it's I've seen a lot of transformation over the years. But Sanofi has over 100 years of history, and this is a company that grew and expanded over and over and over again through mergers and acquisitions over long, long, long periods of time. It officially became Sanofi in the early 70s. But as I said, it had been growing from a very tiny organization to as large as it is right now. Because as you know, we have over 100,000 employees. We're in over 100 countries around the world. So it is a massively big company. Importantly, and I'll talk a little bit about the different areas of business that we're in. But importantly, I think for your podcast is to know that we have been in the space of diabetes also for almost as long as we have existed.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a legacy of about 100-year legacy in the diabetes community. And the focus has always been about transforming the care for people with diabetes, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, we've had the insulins and we've been growing our portfolio of insulins over the years. We have invested a significant amount of resources and money and time in educating the physicians, educating the populations. I will tell you, I remember, you know, it's going to date me, but I remember like in my early years of career, being a sales rep, selling insulins, as you can imagine. And it's been going on for a long time. And at the time, in those years, I can tell you, like 20, 30 years ago, we were starting to educate the primary care market on using insulin as an example. And nobody knew what to do. And there was an enormous amount of discomfort on the part of the primary care, because there's never enough endocrinologists to do all the work, right? So the primary care have to step in. But anyways, long story short, an enormous amount of investment in education and also helping understanding the management of this disease. You know, we pride ourselves in our mission and vision, which is really, you know, we say we chase the miracles of science to improve people's lives. And why the miracle, why we say miracle? Well, you know as well as I do that discovering new innovative treatments and solutions for people with different diseases, whether they're chronic or not, is very, very difficult. We have to, you know, study thousands of compounds or molecules before we get to anything that's ever going to make it to market. So we do chase the miracles of science, but fortunately for us, we've been able to make some really good discoveries in the field of, in the area of diabetes. We're not just invested also in type 1. As you know, we're heavily invested in type 2 diabetes. So we're invested in all forms of diabetes. And now with the advent of TZIELD, and Luigi will certainly talk more about that, we're investing not in just in treating the disease, but trying to slow it down at this point, which is completely a new way of thinking about this disease, you know, and the first probably real innovation in 100 years. But Sanofi, just to wrap things up a little bit on the company itself. So we're in a number of therapeutic areas at this point. So you were very, very heavily invested in immunology and inflammatory diseases with drugs, for instance, Dupixent in a number of inflammatory diseases. We're heavily invested in oncology, rare diseases, rare blood diseases, neurology and vaccines. As you know, we have a whole portfolio of vaccines, including the flu vaccines. So, you know, but at the end of the day, diabetes is one of the core area where we are. We've always invested heavily, and we continue to do so at this point on a number of different fronts. So hopefully that helps answer your question.
Absolutely. That's awesome. I didn't realize that you guys had such a portfolio of things that were going on, like from the surface, because when I first met with the rep here in Columbus, it was like screening. It was like screening. And now that you're talking about it, it's like, oh my God, this makes so much sense now. Like all the things that they got their amazing hands in to make a difference and change lives. That's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Luigi.
And actually, to provide you a clinical perspective, one of the insulins that Sanofi came out with was Lantus insulin. That was launched in 2000. And that completely changed the way that primary care actually were able to manage diabetes. Because up until that point, primary care just was not comfortable using insulin therapy. And I was at the University of Miami then practicing as an endocrinologist. And I remember when that came to market, and we were looking at it for individuals with type 1 diabetes. But what Sanofi brought to the table was the ability to simplify insulin therapy so that now primary care is very comfortable using a basal insulin. And that's where it started back in 2000. So there's a lot of history there that is really important in both the specialist world and the primary care world.
Interesting.
Yeah. I agree, Luigi. And I would say also that as a pharma biotech company, it's also important, in my opinion, and this is something that's very, very, very near and dear to our values as an organization, is that we're not just there to, you know, it's great that we launch innovative medicine. We're very proud of it. But at the end of the day, these medicines are only as good as they get in the right hands, the hands of the right people who need it, right? So as you can imagine, we have a lot of partnerships that we've developed over the decades out there, including with the advocacy organizations, the multitude of advocacy organizations who support and service the patients and the families who need a better education around their disease, or who need support for access, for accessing medicines, right? So we are partnering quite heavily with a lot of these organizations and supporting them in their projects as well. So that's another big area for us of investments.
Yeah, and I love, Nani, the fact that you're bringing up this thought process of getting the medications or getting these things in front of the people that need them. Because the other thing that I always think about with medications is getting it in front of the people that need them, but also giving them the proper education to be able to use that medication. So they're, one, staying safe, but two, not abusing it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the confidence also, like there's a lot of anxiety around having to, especially if you're going to get either on a chronic medication or even something that is a bit more invasive, like an infusion or a sub-Q medication. People have a lot of insecurity around that. And so it's our job and our responsibility to make sure that we provide the right education for so people can make the right choices and the choices that are appropriate for them. So yeah, that's definitely near and dear to our heart. And as you know, in type 1 specifically, Ken, the biggest challenge we have right now as not only as an organization, but as society, frankly, is to educate not only the population and the people with potentially with diabetes, but educate also the medical community around the importance of screening people, right? We screen for all sorts of different diseases in the US market, you know, mandated by the government, mandated by the academies, the different academies. But one area where we haven't seen an evolution quite just yet is the more systematic screening of people who are potentially at risk of type 1 diabetes, you know, and 90% of people don't have a family history. So how do you prevent and support the population? You have to screen them, right? Yeah. This is where the education is needed at this point, is where the transformation of the management of the disease is needed.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up too, Nadi, because when I was first diagnosed, you know, 15 years ago, 17 years ago, it was like genetic. That's all I ever heard was type 1's a genetic disease. It's a genetic disease. You get it when you're a young kid. And I was always sitting there scratching my head. I'm like, okay, well, can you explain this to me? Because it's not in my family whatsoever. I've checked generations. And then on top of that, I'm not a young kid. So I was always scratching my head at the beginning of my journey of saying, okay, well, how did I get it then? If it's a genetic thing, if we have a genetic disposition. And the more I learn and the more I talk to people that are way smarter than me, I started to learn like, okay, well, there's a genetic component, but that's not at all. That's not the whole entire package. That's not everything about type 1 diabetes. And now it's like, and you guys jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. Now I really believe it's caused by a trigger, whatever that trigger might be, whether it's environmental, food-wise, stress-wise, whatever it is. I was a multi-sport athlete my entire life, never rested in college, didn't eat right, had a terrible environment, constantly drank, like just did stupid crap that we do in college. And then now after I'm done with college, now I have type 1 diabetes. So it's a very interesting thing. And I'm glad you brought that up because it's to me, it's one of those things that we have to continue to obviously one, educate ourselves, but two, what is the consensus on this? What is the consensus on what causes type 1 diabetes? Is it a wide variety of things? Because I think that is the thing that people, especially when you're first diagnosed, you're just looking for those answers. And there just seems to be all these conflicting things.
Yep. Luigi, you're we can't hear you, my friend.
Oh, you can't hear me? Oh,
there you go. Yeah, now we got you, buddy.
Now okay, we got you.
So there's a saying in endocrinology that's been there forever that genetics load the gun and the environment pulls the trigger.
Yeah, gotcha.
Obviously, a genetic component, and you're absolutely right. We do not understand all of the genetic component. I think we can explain about 50% of the cases based on genetic background.
Yeah.
But then there are all these triggers, right? Whether they're environmental triggers, viral triggers, food-related triggers, that in some way, shape, or form, just start this autoimmune attack specific to these beta cells, which eventually leads to not enough insulin production, you know, dysglycemia, and eventually type 1 diabetes. And so there's a lot of work that's going on to try and understand the genesis of all this. Because if we can understand it, then we can craft even better solutions to the problem.
Mm. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and we see, and Luigi, I don't know if you want to say a couple of words about this, but we do see an enormous amount of connections with other autoimmune diseases as well when it comes to type 1.
Absolutely. Nadia, absolutely right, because type 1 is an autoimmune disease. And if we look around, there is a high correlation between type 1 and other autoimmune conditions. For example, when you have type 1 diabetes, your risk, your lifelong risk of having a thyroid disorder, either high thyroid or low thyroid, is around 25 to 30%. If you are a kid with type 1 diabetes, your risk of having celiac disease is around 7 to 10%. And then there's a whole bunch of other autoimmune disorders, whether they relate to the adrenals or the pituitary or the stomach, that can also be associated with type 1 diabetes. So there is a strong correlation, and we're trying to understand what the reverse looks like. If you have thyroid disease or you have celiac disease, are you at risk of developing type 1 diabetes? And there's some clear indications that that is the case, and we're trying to better define that.
Yeah, because I've heard the stat of from some dietitian friends that I have that are also type 1. I've heard the stat that, like, when you're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you are at risk to get 1 to 3 additional autoimmune diseases at some point in your life.
Yeah. Actually, there was a recent survey by this group called the T1D Exchange, where they actually asked their members, if you have type 1 diabetes, what other autoimmune conditions do you have? And about 25% of them had at least one, and then about 10%, two conditions. And there were about 4 to 5% of them that listed, I think, 4 or 5 other autoimmune conditions. So, yes, they go together.
We see that a lot, Ken, also when we talk to patients who have type 1 diabetes. We ask them about the other autoimmune disorders that exist in their families, right? So it may not necessarily be the individuals themselves, but, you know, father, mother, you know, sisters, brothers, like what's the situation with the family? And we often see quite a bit of autoimmune disorders.
That's so interesting, because I think we think about autoimmune diseases as being triggers, and that's how they come about. Like you don't have type 1 diabetes, but you have a genetic disposition of another autoimmune disease in your genes, and now you're getting type 1. That's so interesting. I'd never even thought about it that way. I've always thought about type 1 with genetics and like these things are going on, but I've never thought about it as like, okay, well, there's other autoimmunes in the family. Maybe that's part of the trigger. Maybe that's so crazy.
Yeah. And you know what's really interesting? Now, you got type 1 diabetes when you were 25. If you look at the age at which type 1 diabetes diagnosis peaks, it's around 10 to 14 years of age, although there are probably more adults that develop type 1 than there are children just because of the numbers. But when you look at when the immune attack starts, and we measure autoantibodies to do that, right? That's part of the screening. It actually peaks at 2 years of age. And if you're a kid that's going to develop type 1 diabetes by your adolescent years, by 5 years of age, 95% of them already have markers of immune attack. They have autoantibodies that can be measured in the blood to predict those individuals that are going to go on to develop type 1 diabetes.
Interesting.
And so the question is, you developed it at 25 years of age. At what age did you actually develop autoantibodies? And could it be that if they had measured autoantibodies at 10 years of age, a GAD, an IA2, an insulin autoantibody, that they would have identified you as a person that was likely to develop type 1 diabetes? Because We now have a different definition for type 1 diabetes, right? Clinically, type 1 diabetes was you had hyperglycemia, you presented with weight loss, blurring of vision, thirst, and when you presented, oftentimes in diabetic ketoacidosis, that's a very common presentation in children, you had type 1 diabetes, and we could confirm it by doing autoantibodies. Now, type 1 diabetes is actually defined by the presence of these autoantibodies, even before the onset of the high blood sugars, the hyperglycemia. And so we have staging of type 1 diabetes, stage 1, stage 2, and then what we recognize as clinical diabetes, stage 3, that is now in the lexicon. But while we know about it, while you know about it, while screening programs know about it, there are a lot of healthcare professionals that still haven't been exposed to this information. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do, to bring that awareness and to educate healthcare professionals about this new way of looking at type 1 diabetes. And I say new, but this information has been out there in the public domain since at least 2015.
Wow. So this is so interesting because I got to stay on this for a second. So my question is how long can it, like, as an example, like, because you're talking about 2 years old, like if someone is, you guys do screening and we find that the autoantibodies at 2 years old, how long could those autoantibodies be like, or type 1 diabetes from quotation marks, how long could that be in like dormant, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it depends on the number of autoantibodies and sometimes the type of autoantibodies. But just to simplify things, if we detect two or more autoantibodies, and there are about five in total that we can measure, if we detect two or more and they persist, meaning that we repeat that test and there's still two or more, they don't need to be the same, but two or more autoantibodies that are there, we know that over your lifetime, your risk of developing type 1 diabetes approaches 100%. So that puts it in the grand scheme perspective. Now, if I detect two autoantibodies, but your blood sugars are completely normal, we call this stage 1 type 1 diabetes. And there, we expect about 50% of those individuals to develop type 1 diabetes by about 4 or 5 years.
Mm.
40 to 50%. It's a ballpark figure. Now, if you have two or more autoantibodies, what we also would want to do is to see what your glucose status is, because your autoantibodies are telling us that there's an immune attack on your beta cells. Your beta cell mass and function, the amount of insulin that your beta cells can secrete, can make, can produce, is coming down. And so we want to measure your glucose status. Your glucose status is completely normal, that's stage 1. If your glucose status is not in the diabetes range, but not in the normal range, almost in the pre-diabetes range, and the term that we use is dysglycemia, then your risk of developing type 1 diabetes, clinical type 1 diabetes, over a 4-year period is 75%. 3 out of 4 individuals will develop clinical type 1 diabetes within 4 years. And so that gives us some parameters for thinking about, well, what can we do during that period of time to prepare individuals for an eventual diagnosis of diabetes, to prevent the possibility of diabetic ketoacidosis, which 40 to 60% of kids present with at diagnosis, to potentially provide them with interventions, clinical interventions. And we'll talk, we can talk about those in a minute. Or there are also research studies that are going on that in stage 1 or stage 2 or stage 3 that are also a potential avenue. So it's really important. But if we don't screen, we can't identify these individuals. And without identifying these individuals, we're not going to make the changes in the healthcare systems that are needed for type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. And Luigi, I think just to couple what you were saying, we also have to think about these individuals who, you know, whose autoantibodies are not going to start showing up as rapidly. In some other individuals, it's going to show up very slowly. So they'll develop one, then it's going to take many years before they develop another one, which is why you see people diagnosed with type 1 today, you know, in their 20s and 30s and 40s. And we have people even at a later age than that develop type 1 diabetes. So as you were saying earlier, Ken, we don't always know what trigger is going to provoke what. But you know, it used to be that type 1 diabetes was considered to be a juvenile disease, like a children's disease. And now we're finding out that that's not the case. You know, you have many people who develop it in their adult years. And now here's the dilemma, right? So when you talk about screening, people always think about, you know, if there is type 1 in your family, type 1 diabetes in your family, it makes total sense that you would want to screen everybody in your family. That's still not even happening today, but that would make total sense. But if you know that 90% of people who develop type 1 diabetes, just like yourself, had no family history whatsoever, what it means is, you know, you should be screening everybody to make sure that we don't miss anyone. Because although it seems a little crazy to think you screen everybody, the reality is for those who do end up developing it, it's a pretty dramatic lifestyle change, right? And wouldn't you want to be able to have access to something that might help you delay the onset of the disease? And so that's the dilemma that we had, the societal dilemma right now, which is how do we transform the way this is being prevented and managed?
Hmm. And Nadia, the one thing to add there is that the importance of the presentation of somebody, of a kid with type 1 diabetes, if they have a family history or not. Because if there's another child in the family that has type 1 diabetes, that family is probably a little hyper aware of what's going on and may be able to reduce the likelihood that a second child presents with DKA. However, the 90% that do not have a family history, the presentations are often a lot more acute, and the risk of diabetic ketoacidosis much, much higher.
Yeah. So I think this is, God, this is so interesting. So I think the next question I have for you guys to play like the healthcare person I am, or the health person I am, the devil's advocate, like not even devil's advocate, because Luigi, you're saying like, what are the like steps that we can take if we find this person tests for two or more autoantibodies? Mm-hmm. Outside of the medication piece, where we're going to go into in just a second, are there other steps that someone could take, like changing up their lifestyle, exercising more, changing up their relationship with food and how they're consuming food? Are there other steps that they could be taking to either delay or not get type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And one of the most important things that needs to happen if you identify a person with two or more autoantibodies, so that they have early stage type 1 diabetes, is monitoring of their glucose levels over time. And that can be done with fasting glucose, with an A1C, no glucose tolerance test. You're familiar with continuous glucose monitor, I'm sure. And that can also be used to kind of track glucose levels. And what you're trying to do there is you're trying to monitor for progression of beta cell failure. And you're trying to prevent a child or sometimes even an adult presenting with acute hyperglycemia, with acute diabetic ketoacidosis. That's first and foremost. Now, you mentioned diet and exercise, and there are studies that actually show that in individuals who have autoimmunity for the type 1 diabetes, haven't developed the diabetes yet, the hyperglycemia yet, that proper diet and physical activity will slow the progression to clinical type 1 diabetes. It won't really change the autoimmunity part of it, but it will certainly change the environment. And as you well know, proper diet and proper physical activity will reduce insulin needs, reduce insulin resistance, improve beta cell function, at least temporarily, improve insulin sensitivity, all things that can at least in their own way push out a little bit more the diagnosis, but clearly not enough to make much of a difference, but still, as you point out, really important.
Yeah. I think the other thing that I'm very interested on, because you mentioned, as we're talking about this, you mentioned CGMs. And mm-hmm. I know for all of those who are listening all over the world, I know here in America, if you are not insulin dependent, it is very hard to get a CGM from your insurance because they won't pay for it. So it's interesting that you're bringing up that thought process. I think that is an amazing thing that if you have autoantibodies, you get on a CGM because now you can track what your blood sugar is 100%. But it's like, again, me playing devil's advocate in my head. Okay, well, that's incredible that we're saying that, but that's really hard for a lot of people to be able to do, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the easier thing to do is to send somebody home with a glucose meter and tell them, you know, once a week, check a fasting glucose and maybe check a glucose after a large meal, a couple hours after a large meal, and just make sure that the values are still within a reasonable range. CGMs that can be used by clinics or healthcare professionals where they can put a blinded CGM on somebody and just record the values. Because, right, if you have all antibodies are positive, you're already concerned that, okay, I'm going to develop type 1 diabetes at a certain point. If I see all these CGM values coming in, and we put CGM on individuals that have no diabetes, and you see some wacky stuff after Chinese food and pizza.
Yeah.
And so you do not want to create anxiety and burden. And so a lot of times, healthcare professionals will put a blinded CGM periodically on somebody that's autoantibody positive and just use that to kind of, you know, get a sense as to where they're going. Yeah. And for example, the Barbara Davis Center in Colorado has a lot of experience in doing that type of stuff. But yes, I agree. I personally, give me a glucose meter, let me check every once in a while and not be obsessed. Yeah. By this issue, right?
Yeah, because I know I've had multiple conversations on this show from the exercise point of view, because a lot of my colleagues out there from the exercise point are using the Abbott Libre with these other companies that are trying to bring CGM to the market for people that aren't insulin dependent, and just seeing incredible things after they eat something very simple that has a little bit of starch in it. So it's like, I think it's like both sides of the coin that we're like talking about with the CGM piece. But I think that this I've always said that the CGM is the new wave of the future for looking at overall health, because blood sugar tells us so much about your overall health and what's going on, not just for someone that lives with diabetes. So, yeah. Let's move into the medication piece, because I really want the listeners to know that this is available for them. So if you guys can just tell us like what medications are available, what are we doing with the medications, how are we using them, how long, like that type of stuff. How long would you use it if you have two or more autoantibodies and you're trying to delay the onset of type 1? How long should you be using this? That type of stuff.
Nadia, do you want me to take this?
Yeah, go for it. Go for it. You're the doc. We're listening.
you're a doc as well by this point. Nadia's incredible in terms of absorbing information and being able to process it. So the only treatment that is currently indicated to delay the progression of type 1 diabetes is called teplizumab. And it's a monoclonal antibody, which means it's an antibody that can attach to a very specific part of a white blood cell. And that part is called a CD3 receptor. And the CD3 receptor is important because that's the way that white cells communicate with the rest of the immune system and enhance an attack on whatever it is that they're attacking, whether it's a foreign particle or, in this case, a beta cell. And so what teplizumab does, the Tzield teplizumab, is go on the CD3 receptor, and basically over time, it exhausts these T cells. They just get tired to the point where they're unable to recruit their buddies to continue destroying beta cells. They're unable to secrete, or they're less able to secrete what are called cytokines. These are things that cause inflammation around the area. And they're less able to recruit beta cells to produce antibodies to get in there. And so what it does is it basically cools down this immune attack that's going on beta cell. Teplizumab right now is indicated for the treatment of stage 2 type 1 diabetes. And stage 2 type 1 diabetes, as we discussed, is somebody who has autoimmunity going on. So they have two or more autoantibodies that have been found, and their glucose levels are in that pre-diabetes range, right? They're not in the diabetes range yet. They're not normal. They're in this pre-diabetes range. And that's not the term that's used. The term that's used is dysglycemia. But I think listeners can understand pre-diabetes. And the values are about the same. And so in those individuals, an infusion of teplizumab, an infusion of Tzield, can delay the progression from stage 2 to stage 3, that's clinical diabetes, by up to 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
And if you don't do anything, the placebo arm within 2 years has type 1 diabetes, at least 75% of them. And so there is not a prevention of type 1 diabetes, but there's a substantial delay. And what does that mean? I mean, I'll ask you, what would a delay of 4 or 5 years mean for somebody with who's at risk of developing type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, I think as a young kid, it means everything. It means everything as a young kid. I want to say for an adult, it also means as much. I think about my diagnosis, and it's hard to put, it's hard for me to say like, oh, it means everything, because I was in denial for 3 years. So I didn't even really deal with it. And I know from the time that I woke up out of that denial and really started focusing on not just the health aspect of my life, but also the diabetes, the blood sugars, getting everything under control, and even just learning what was going to work for me. If at that point, when that process was going on, someone told me like, hey, you're diagnosed with diabetes now, but we have this medication that can help you, I think that it at that stage of my life, like it would have been amazing, 100%.
Yep, that's right. There's no need to monitor blood sugars because you don't have hyperglycemia. There's no need to take the 180 decisions that somebody with type 1 diabetes takes on a daily basis in terms of food, activity, exercise. And you're right, the pushback sometimes is, well, in adults, we've got great technology, but you're an athlete. I am sure that even with the best technology, when you're exercising, post-exercise and what have you, that those blood sugars don't behave the way that you would like them to behave. And so, you know, there are so many ways. And as you say, in children, it especially for those that understand what it means to be a child and have type 1 diabetes, it's huge. It's mind-blowingly huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, Ken, I think for us as an organization, we have a significant commitment to the type 1 diabetes community, just like we do for the type 2 diabetes community. And with this new innovative medicine, we are exceedingly committed to making sure that we educate the medical community as well as the families and the patients or the potential future patients that this exists, that there's an opportunity to screen and identify the autoantibodies early, and that they should take advantage of it, right? And we also have to work with the authorities to make sure that the academies are sending the right signal and the right message to their community, their medical community and their members, as well as to the authorities and the decision makers and the politicians that, you know, screening for type 1 diabetes, given the options we have today, should not be a privilege to only a few, but should be a standard opportunity for everyone in the U.S. market in 2024. So that is the mandate and the commitment that we have. And as I said, we're working fast and furious, and we're investing in this space. And we're the only ones right now, you know, investing in doing this in type 1 diabetes. There is nobody else playing in this space at the moment. So it's a big commitment for us.
Yeah, I love that. As we get closer to the end here, I have two more questions for you guys. One is going to be a personal question for me, and then the other from me, and then the other one is going to be just a question for the families, the listeners that are listening right now. If someone wants more information, if someone wants to connect, if someone wants to connect with you guys and just with the company and just get more information, how do they do that? That's the first thing. And the second thing, how does someone, if someone's ready right now, it's like, I got three kids, one of them is diabetic, or I've got three kids or however many kids in the family, but I'm a diabetic myself as a parent and I want to get my kids screened. How do they go about doing that?
That's a great question. And we're at Sanofi, we don't give any clinical advice, right? We educate HCPs and what have you. And so the best advice that we could give is is to talk to your doctor. And your doctor has a lot of information or can get a lot of information, or talk to experts that your doctor might refer you to. And some of those experts, for example, I mentioned the Barbara Davis Center in Colorado. They have a website called asktheexperts.org that either healthcare professionals or individuals that are at risk or even with diabetes can call and get information about what it means to have two autoantibodies, what might be some of the other steps, how do I get more educated, how do I prepare, how do I find out. And so very important that that individuals that want to have more information or that test positive for these antibodies talk to their primary care doctor.
Yeah, and just to add to what Luigi was saying, you know, certainly tzeal.com also has some information where people can get in, you know, can get references there too. But we're not the ones practicing medicine, right? So it's not for us to intervene in between in the relationship between the patient and the doctor. But we also, however, recognize that today the market is very uneducated generally about screening and screening for type 1 diabetes. And so it's not unusual for people who acquire information, go meet with their primary care practitioners, and get met with either resistance or lack of knowledge and understanding of what to do. It's not unusual that we see that. We see that all the time. And that's why I think the Barbara Davis Center resource that Luigi was just mentioning is so critical, because this is a center of excellence in diabetes, right? There are a few across the country, but this is a perfect example of a center of excellence in diabetes. And when you reach out to them for information, or when you, if you want to connect your primary care practitioner with the diabetes, with the Barbara Davis Center, they will be able to not only educate them, but also guide, you know, on what to do and what the next steps are. And that's an extremely important resource for the population.
I love that. It's an interesting thing. I was just thinking about this too, as you both were talking about that, is I can't imagine for your company how hard it must be to get the information out there, because there's such a barrier. And also not just that, but if you're not in the diabetes community, you don't have any family member or whatever, like, you don't realize that it's a problem until you're actually diagnosed.
You're 100% right. That hence lies the perfect dilemma, right? So, and that's why at this stage, like, we're working our hardest, and we're investing a lot in, first and foremost, in educating the families of people who already have type 1 diabetes, because it's a natural, logical way to enter and start to make an impact, right? But the reality is, because 90% of people don't have a family history, this is the hard work. This is where the hard work lies, which is educating and convincing people to act and be proactive, and rather than ending up you know, with diabetes ketoacidosis in an emergency room. Like, how do you proactively manage this condition and identify people early? And that is the hardest part of our job. Yes.
Yeah.
But you know what? We're committed to doing it.
Absolutely. If you guys weren't, then who's gonna do it?
Exactly right.
And there, Ken, I think for those that don't have a personal connection to type 1 diabetes, the stories of those that do are really, really powerful. And you can see it when you have a family that gets up there and describes the journey of their child developing DK, ending up in an intensive care unit, and the burden of having to take care of the diabetes. That really resonates, and it's important for both healthcare professionals and individuals that may not have a family history to understand what that means.
Yeah, 100%. I just know, like, it's not in my family. Nobody I ever knew growing up in adulthood had type 1 diabetes. I might have even known one or two people that have type 2. I didn't even know that many people with type 2. And even when I was diagnosed, I was naively under the impression, I went to my family care practitioner, and they tested me for, you know, my blood sugar or whatever, because I told them what the symptoms were. I only had excessive urination and thirst. That was my only two symptoms whatsoever. And they tested me twice because they didn't believe it. I was like over 450 and felt like $1 million. And they came back and said, well, we think you might have type 1 diabetes. And I'm like, what? What the? Are you serious? Like, how? Like, I was naively thinking that I'm not overweight, I'm not unhealthy, so I don't have diabetes. And that has been a huge message for me throughout my whole entire journey with diabetes, because everyone thinks that. If you're not in the type 1 community, you think that. Everyone thinks that. I get that question all the time when I tell someone I'm a diabetic, because I specifically say diabetes or diabetic and not type 1 because I want to see what their response is, because I'm an educator and I like to educate people. But it's such an interesting conversation when you have with people and have with this, with society, with like, okay, this stigmatism needs to stop, because that's part of the issue and part of the problem that we're running up against with being able to have amazing technology, being able to have amazing education and tell people about things that, that they could do, like your company and what you guys are doing.
Yeah, no, yeah. You're absolutely right, Ken. Listen, I think at the end of the day, you've got our commitment. We're going to keep working hard to educate and to provide the right level of knowledge to both the medical community and the population so that we can effect some real change in the U.S. market. And so that's a commitment that we have.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for doing this, guys. This was
a pleasure.
I'm so happy that I got to connect with both of you. I'm going to make sure that I have both of your emails in case I ever have questions, and I want to like pick your brains. I'm so excited that I got you guys on. I got the company on to just tell the world about this amazing technology. So, thank you so much again for you guys coming on.
Yeah. Thank you, Ben, and keep doing the good work, because this is the way that the message gets out, and it's such an important message. So thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Thank you for what you do. We appreciate it. It's so important. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm also very glad that I got the information as well, because for me, screening has always been a question mark for me. I have two little girls myself. Mm. And
there you go.
You know, so it's always been a question mark for me. And I'm glad that now I have more information, more data, more understanding about what it actually is, and the ultimate thing that could happen with this information that we have available to us.
Well, there you go.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Very nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Yeah, I will talk to everybody later. Thank you so much.
You bet. Bye.